and about how the evil sexist patriarchy is conspiring against them. Frankly, I was tired of it 25 years ago, but now I'm downright exhausted. Why now? Because of a particular feminist named Nancy Hopkins. Miss Hopkins is the MIT biology professor who famously stalked out of a conference in early 2005 because she couldn't endure the indignity of Harvard President Lawrence Summers floating an idea that she didn't like. What Summers had the gall to speculate on was the possibility, let me repeat, the possibility that there might be innate differences between the sexes in math and science. This insult left Hopkins so shaken that she says she almost fainted. After she regained what passes for her composure, Hopkins went to the Boston Globe with all the sordid details of what Summers said about men and women. And before you could say PC alert, Lawrence Summers, that insensitive brute, was walking around with a target on his back, the object of a campaign to get him booted from his job. Summers, for his part, responded with the guts and character we've come to associate with the leaders of today's great universities. He apologized, not once, not twice, but by last count 12 million times. It's humiliating, a once courageous president of a great university practically begging for forgiveness for throwing out for consideration a controversial idea. All this, as you probably know by now, touched off the academic equivalent of World War III. The New York Times alone ran 40,000 stories on the subject, several more stories than the paper ran on World War II, which just happened to be a real war. Then, in March 2005, Harvard's Faculty of Arts and Sciences passed a resolution stating very simply and directly that the faculty lacks confidence in the leadership of Lawrence H. Summers. Harvard has been around for nearly 400 years and has seen a lot, but nothing like that had ever happened before. But we shouldn't be too harsh on Harvard's faculty in general or Professor Hopkins in particular. They have an excuse. Politically correct idiocy is a way of life on our most elite college campuses. Susan Estrich, on the other hand, has no such excuse. While it's true that Estrich teaches law part-time at USC, she mainly has lived in the real world. In 1998, she managed Michael Dukakis's presidential campaign. Disastrously, but that wasn't entirely her fault. Dukakis helped. More recently, she's been a contributor to Fox News, and more often than not, she has something interesting to say. But right around the same time Nancy Hopkins was hyperventilating in the East, Estrich was blowing a gasket out west, screaming gender discrimination because, in her view, not enough women were showing up on the op-ed page of her local paper, the LA Times. In Susan's world, this is practically a crime against humanity, so she launched a vicious personal campaign against the section's editor, Michael Kinsley, the same Michael Kinsley who was about the most liberal, pro-feminist male journalist around. When Kinsley, who is battling Parkinson, sidestepped Ms. Estrich's demand that he institute a de facto quota to ensure, as she put it, that women's voices are heard in public discourse in our community, she lashed out at him in a private email that didn't stay private for long, writing that people are beginning to think your illness may have affected your brain, your judgment, and your ability to do this job. Let me be clear. I have zero affection for Michael Kinsley, a nasty little man who over the years has often shown himself as a mean-spirited intellectual bully. But the behavior of Susan Estrich, so typical of the victim feminist willingness to say just about anything, no matter how contemptible, to achieve her idea of justice, is about as low as it gets. Except that the behavior of Professor Hopkins, because it sent so many like-minded elitists into such a tizzy, was just a tad lower, which is why she made the list and Estrich missed out. Barely. And while these two major league feminists embarrassed themselves and liberal feminism in general, it took another woman, the gifted essayist Heather MacDonald, to put her finger on the whole sorry situation. It is curious how feminists, when crossed, turn into shrill, hysterical harpies, she wrote, adding, or in the case of MIT's Nancy Hopkins, delicate flowers who collapse at the slightest provocation, precisely the images of women that they claim patriarchal sexists have fabricated to keep them down. 35. Jeff Danziger. Let's play pretend. Let's pretend that a conservative political cartoonist who detests the liberal politics of, say, Jesse Jackson, portrays him in a cartoon as a semi-literate Uncle Tom, with no shoes and big fat lips. Let's also pretend that in this cartoon, old Jesse is sitting in a rocking chair in a pair of scruffy blue jeans muttering, I don't knows nothing about affirmative action. Now let's play real life. Jeff Danziger is a liberal political cartoonist who detests the conservative politics of Condoleezza Rice, so he portrayed her as a semi-literate Aunt Jemima with no shoes and big fat lips who is sitting in a rocking chair. She's holding an aluminum tube as if it were a baby and proclaiming her ignorance of her field of expertise, War and Peace. In Danziger's cartoon, Rice, who was a Russia scholar, former provost at Stanford University, concert pianist, former national security advisor to President Bush, and now Secretary of State, is drawn barefoot wearing a house dress and saying, I knows all about aluminum tubes. Correction, I don't know nothing about aluminum tubes. The tubes in question are supposed to be the aluminum tubes that Saddam Hussein had imported, apparently, as it turns out, to make conventional missiles. Ms. Rice had suggested during the lead-up to the war that he might have wanted them to make a nuclear device. Get it? As a Wall Street Journal editorial, which pointed this piece of nastiness out, says, Mr. Danziger, a proud member of the media's Bush Lied Brigade, is making a point about the administration's supposed manipulation of pre-war intelligence on Iraq. The caption is an apparent reference to Prissy, the house slave in Gone with the Wind, who uttered something similar about babies. Ah, but the good news is that we're all too sensitive and got the whole thing wrong. I know this because after it hit the fan, Danziger explained that the cartoon wasn't racist at all, because the idea, he said, was suggested to me by a friend who is African-American. You can't make this stuff up. Danziger is such a PC liberal that it doesn't even occur to him that black people can be just as bigoted as anyone else, especially when the target is another black person who has a different point of view. For liberals, the journal notes, Condi Rice's real crime is bucking Democratic orthodoxy and working for a conservative president. This makes her fair game for race-based attacks, even when the issue at hand has absolutely nothing to do with race. She is a black woman who, in Mr. Danziger's view, has wandered off the liberal plantation, and this is his way of putting Ms. Rice and other black conservatives in their place, the journal said. Mr. Danziger, I suspect, is many things, but none more than a poster boy for white, liberal racism. 34. Bill Moyers. I really don't want to do this one. Years ago, when I was a CBS News correspondent, Bill Moyers and I were colleagues. I liked him. While too many other network journalists and their ratings-obsessed bosses were more than happy doing magazine stories about killer dogs and demented stalkers, Bill Moyers invariably took the high road. When I knew him, Bill was not just a smart man, he was also a thoughtful and reasonable man. Here's where the butt comes in. But something happened to him over the years, and to a lot of others on the left, too. Charles Krauthammer, the conservative columnist, who was also a smart, thoughtful, and reasonable man, calls it the unhinging of the Democratic Party. Krauthammer believes that Democrats are seized with a loathing for President Bush, a contempt and disdain giving way to a hatred that is near pathological, unlike any since they had Richard Nixon to kick around. Hello, Bill Moyers. In fact, Krauthammer's column came in the wake of a speech Moyers gave at a Take Back America rally, where, after the usual left-wing stuff, he condemned the unholy alliance between government and wealth and mocked the compassionate conservative spin that tries to make the rape of America sound like a consensual date, as he put it, he went over the cliff into full Bush derangement syndrome, to use Krauthammer's term. Moyers raved in that earnest way of his that right-wing wrecking crews were out to bankrupt the government in order to enrich the corporate interests, and that, "I think this is a deliberate, intentional destruction of the United States of America." Charging that conservatives are out to deliberately and intentionally destroy our country is not, to put it mildly, the language of a judicious man. It is not the way liberals used to talk or the way they used to be. Yet, like it or not, this is the language of today's left and of its high priest, Bill Moyers. When the story broke about the abuse at Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison, Moyers was among the first to draw a moral equivalency between the sexual humiliation of Iraqi prisoners and the beheading of American Nick Berg. All of us, as he put it to a left-wing philosopher who was the guest on his PBS show that week, have been holding in our heads simultaneously this week those images, the images of the terrorist beheading the young American from Pennsylvania, and the images of what happened in that prison. "Is one of those atrocities more reprehensible than the other?" he asked. "It's enough to make you choke on your brie and spit up your chablis." So is this from Mr. Moyers on those big bad racist conservatives. "The right gets away with blaming liberals for their efforts to help the poor," he tells an interviewer, "but what the right is really objecting to is the fact that the poor are primarily black." Bill is entitled to his politics, no matter how odd or how stale they may be. But this nonsense about conservatives wanting to rape and pillage the land and detesting everybody who is poor, especially when they're also black, is not reasonable discourse. It's vitriol, and we already have way too much of that in the national conversation. The problem is, Bill just can't help himself. On election night 2004, as the votes were coming in, he was on the Charlie Rose show saying that if Kerry were to win in a tight race, "I think there'd be an effort to mount a coup." "A coup?" Rose incredulously asked. "I don't believe the right wing would accept a Kerry victory," Moyer said, in absolute seriousness. Charles Krauthammer has written that Bill Moyers' deferential demeanor and almost avuncular television style has made him the Mr. Rogers of American politics. Too bad this Mr. Rogers wandered out of his old neighborhood and got lost in some dark alley. Too bad Mr. Rogers became unhinged. 33. Bob Schrum. It's no surprise that Bob Schrum, the Democratic political consultant, media guru, speechwriter, and all-around liberal superstar, tends to get such good press. It helps, of course, when you have the right ideology, but it helps even more when you're part of the club. And Schrummy, as he's known inside the Beltway, has been in the club a very long time. In his clips, the same words pop up over and over: brilliant, gifted, tough-minded. As one of the key advisors to John Kerry in the last presidential campaign, and long the alter ego of Kerry's patron and fellow Massachusetts liberal, Ted Kennedy, Schrum is also often described as committed and principled. The episode usually cited to back this up is his resignation, "in light of my own convictions," as he put it, from the Jimmy Carter campaign back in 1976, because he felt Carter was drifting too far to the right. Virtually every one of the many Democratic candidates he's handled, including fantastically wealthy ones like Goldman Sachs chief John Corzine in New Jersey and department store heir Mark Dayton in Minnesota, has tried to incite class warfare, pitting the middle class, where by some lucky coincidence most of the votes are, against the rich. while this tired, supposedly populist attempt to turn one group of Americans against another based on how much money they have in the bank is silly, especially coming from guys who have more cash than Belgium, it's pretty much par for liberal politics. But what makes Bob Shrum different, though this is one of the things you almost never learn from the media profiles, is that on the domestic issue that matters more than any other, race, his influence has been nothing less than poisonous. Quite simply, just about no one in American politics since the time of George Wallace, no one who graduated from the Harvard Law School and hangs out with so many powerful, mainstream, supposedly respectable people anyway, has been willing to play the race card more viciously or unscrupulously. Take the Maryland gubernatorial campaign he ran for Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, Bobby Kennedy's daughter, in 2002. Shrum apparently was concerned that the Republican candidate, who had a black running mate, was making inroads with black voters, so he had his candidate link opposition to racial preferences, the Republican position, to supporting slavery and lynching. "He opposes affirmative action based on race," Miss Kennedy said of her opponent in front of a predominantly black audience. "Well, let me tell you," she said, "slavery was based on race, lynching was based on race, and affirmative action should be based on race." So, if you oppose preferences based on race, you're a bigot? That was clearly the message from the brilliant Bob Shrum. Incite the crowd, turn the races against each other. Hey, anything to win an election, right? And just in case you think that this was an aberration, take a look at how Shrum ran the campaign to defeat 209, the effort put together by liberal activists to block California's 1996 voter initiative aimed at ending racial preferences in university admissions and hiring. As Ward Connerly, the black businessman who was 209's chief supporter, said after voters had passed the measure, its opponents launched what he called a vituperative barrage of unprecedented ferocity and deception. The most disgusting part of this was a TV ad that Shrum put on the air in the last week of the campaign. Over visuals of burning crosses, Ku Klux Klanners, and shots of David Duke, it intoned, "David Duke wants you to vote yes on 209. Get it? Only a bigot of KKK proportions would support an initiative to end racial preferences. The conservative National Review called the spot one of the most demagogic political ads ever to appear on television. In fact, David Duke actually had been invited to join the debate by students at Cal State Northridge who opposed 209 and were trying to embarrass its supporters. It was a low-class and stupid thing to do, but they were just college kids, so maybe they would someday learn the difference between decency and indecency. For Bob Shrum, the principled man so admired by respectable people and the mainstream media, it's way past too late. A point that didn't seem to faze the liberal elites at New York University, who in January 2005 hired Shrum, the renowned political strategist, as they put it, as a senior fellow to teach young people about public service. So, in case you were wondering where the next generation of left-wing class and race warriors will come from, now you know. '32, Jerry Springer. My favorite description of the Jerry Springer Show is that it's the television equivalent of a churning mass of maggots devouring rotten meat. Except, of course, that's way too kind to Jerry and grossly unfair to the maggots. I understand how easy it is to write Jerry Springer off as just some smarmy but harmless guy doing a smarmy but harmless television show. I mean, what could be more harmless than the one he did about the love-struck guy who was happily married for 5 glorious years to his horse? Given the life-and-death problems we have these days, like terrorism, is this something we really need to worry about? In a word, absolutely. Let's put it this way. If they had TV in ancient Rome, the Jerry Springer Show would have been the biggest hit in the land, just before the empire came crashing down on itself. Here, every day, as the City Journal observes, in some markets, twice and three times a day, family members blithely detail their shared carnal adventures, and morbidly obese, slatternly foul-mouthed women battle over useless, slack-jawed men, while the audience, whose female members get in on the act by exposing their breasts in exchange for bead necklaces, urge them on with chants of whore, 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 or less creatively, Jerry, Jerry, Jerry. But give him this much. Jerry Springer is as good as they get when it comes to making millions off of losers. This is someone who parades these half-wits in front of a national audience, encourages them to humiliate themselves, even if they're too dense to realize what they're doing, and then smiles, no, smirks is closer to it, from the corner of the studio as he takes in the whole sorry scene. As they hail him with their moronic, Jerry, 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 he understands what pathetic bastards they all are, the ones in the audience no less than the ones on the stage. Many years ago, on May 9, 1961 to be exact, a wise man named Newton Minow, who was the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, simply but devastatingly described television as a vast wasteland. When television is good, he said, nothing is better. But when television is bad, nothing is worse. It was true then, and thanks to Jerry Springer and the other maggots that have descended on the rotten meat, it sadly is even truer today. 31. Maury Povich. There are some days when Maury Povich actually makes Jerry Springer appear decent. Watch both shows in succession, and you'll discover that there's not enough soap and water in all of North America to make you feel clean ever again. I understand that some of you may find this hard to believe, since Povich is supposed to be far more respectable. He's an ex-newsman, after all, turned talk show host. But the fact is, Maury is just as smarmy as Jerry, and also very much in the exploitation of losers business, making lots and lots of money off of people whose lives are in some form of chaos or another. Because there's just so much of that crap you can put on without looking like a pervert yourself, Maury used his Ivy League education, he went to Penn, and came up with a surefire gimmick to break through the clutter of daytime TV. Kids. Yes, all kinds of kids. White kids, black kids, brown kids, tall kids, short kids, boy kids, girl kids, any kind of kid, as long as it's a dysfunctional kid, or a kid who comes from a dysfunctional family. In one way or another, almost every Maury show is about kids these days. Kids who dress like whores. Kids who are violent. Kids who tell their mothers what they can do with themselves. Kids who are in gangs. Kids who ran away from home. There was one Maury show that wasn't about the usual kind of dysfunctional kid. In fact, it was barely about kids at all, unless you count babies as kids, which is exactly what this show was about. Actually, it was about a certain kind of baby, the kind that is humongous, the kind of baby who is so big and so fat that he looks more like a sumo wrestler than an infant. Of course, the infants couldn't come on the show alone, so they brought their sorry mothers with them, who picked fights with the slugs in the studio audience, who were booing the moms for bragging about how they let their kids eat just about anything that isn't nailed down. This is the kind of show that makes Maury so special. There was 3-year-old Jordan, who weighed 117 pounds. There was 5-year-old Jessica, who tipped the scales at 205. And just in case someone in the audience was legally blind and couldn't see how big and fat these kids were, Maury made sure there were plenty of close-ups. One tight shot showed a huge baby in diapers who was devouring a leg of fried chicken, the grease glistening on his fat face. Of course, at the end of the show, there was that wonderful, warm Maury touch. He brought out the expert, who gently advised the moms that letting their kids eat crap all day isn't really healthy. You see, Maury cares about kids. In fact, he cares so much about kids that he came up with a theme show that he runs almost every other day, aimed, I'm sure, at helping kids. This one is about paternity tests. This is how the City Journal described Maury's paternity test shows, each featuring five or six depressingly similar segments. A woman, usually very young and very often a minority, comes on stage and declares either angrily or tearfully that she knows a given man is the father of her child. After a couple of minutes of this, the accused male walks out, often depending on how he's just been characterized, to jeers from the audience, and just as vigorously denies he is the father. The denial routinely involves his using the large photo of the child in question at the back of the set, pointing out how dramatically this or that of the child's features differs from his own. He'll often cast aspersions on the mother's character, too, peppered with variations of the words slut and whore, is how the City Journal described it. As Whitney Matheson put it in her USA Today column, Povich's talk show is without doubt the worst thing on television, period. But how can that be, as long as Jerry Springer is still alive? Don't be fooled by the press shirt and pleated khakis, Matheson continued. Maury is miles farther down the commode than Jerry Springer. I agree, but at least Maury cares about the kids, about their pathetic parents, but mostly about Maury. 30. Latrell Sprewell. In late 2004, Latrell Sprewell, who plays basketball for the Minnesota Timberwolves, announced that he had a problem. He was worried about being able to feed his family. At the time, he was making $14.6 million a year. But what really had Latrell worried is that the Timberwolves wanted to pay him a mere $21 million for the next three seasons, which, if you do the math, you'll realize comes out to a measly $7 million a year. Latrell said the offer was insulting. Why not help the T-Wolves win the NBA title this season, a reporter asked him, and then see what happens? To which Latrell Sprewell responded, why would I want to help them win a title? They're not doing anything for me. Spree, my man, if you can't feed your family on $14.6 million a year, or even $7 million, you're not shopping in the right places, or your family's eating way too much. Sure, people say dumb things all the time, and when given the opportunity to take them back, do just that. Latrell Sprewell, however, is not one of those people. The very next day, he was asked if he regretted playing the Feed My Family card, knowing that thousands of his fans in Minnesota were out of work, with winter on the way. That's where I can be if something happens to me, Sprewell replied. Some of us remember a time in this country when athletes could actually relate to their fans, when even famous athletes lived in the same communities as the people who went to see them play, when some ballplayers took public transportation to the game. They got paid more than some guy hauling ice, but not that much more. A lot of players had to take jobs in the offseason to make ends meet. Still, we shouldn't fault Sprewell or any other athlete for being rich. That's capitalism. And we shouldn't condemn them either for spending their gazillions any way they want. It's their money. But we can't fault them for a few other things that have turned sports ugly, like cheating, then justifying it on grounds that everybody else is doing it. Steroids, anyone? And we can fault them, too, for the look-at-how-great-I-am routines we have come to endure whenever some egomaniac catches a 2-yard pass, then parades around the field like he just found a cure for cancer. And while we're at it, we can fault Latrell Sprewell for being so self-absorbed that he doesn't know how good he has it, and for the contempt that he and a lot of others show their fans, without whom there would be no big-time professional sports industry in this country. For the record, most athletes are good guys. A lot of them do charity work. They go to hospitals or do public service ads for the United Way. They high-five their fans after a game, sometimes throw them a jersey. I've seen Sprewell in post-game TV interviews and thought, is this the same guy who choked his coach? He always came across as a thoughtful and decent guy. But it's tough to ignore an athlete who can be as dense as Sprewell seems to be. When he asked, "Why would I want to help my team win a title?" the answer was simple. If not for yourself and your teammates, then do it for the fans, because they're the ones who scrimp and save to take their kids to just one game a season, because they're the ones who have to pay the exorbitant ticket and parking and soda and hot dog prices so that guys like Latrell Sprewell can get their millions. That's why. After all, as Rick Riley, the Sports Illustrated columnist, put it, on the official 10 most selfish, greedy, spoil-to-the-spleen, multimillionaire athletes you'd most like see thrown to a dieting lion list, you'd have to rank Latrell Sprewell 1 through at least 8. 29. John Green. The headline writers called it the fracas at the palace. David Stern, the commissioner of the National Basketball Association, said it was an unprecedented fiasco. The guys who keep track of these things concluded it was the nastiest incident in the NBA's 58-year history. Tens of millions of us saw the video of the brawl in Detroit, the one that was ignited by a disgruntled fan, John Green, who threw his cup of beer at a player named Ron Artest of the visiting Indiana Pacers. After that, as they say, all hell broke loose. Not only was it the worst fight in NBA history, it is believed to be the most violent episode between fans and professional athletes in U.S. sports history. But the really bad news is that the episode in Detroit was only the most visible example of something gone very wrong throughout the world of American sports, a part of our culture that is supposed to entertain us and at times even inspire us. Take your kid to a pro football game sometime, and there's a good chance you'll hear the guy in the next row screaming that some player who just fumbled is a f***ing moron. Or go to your local Little League ballpark. The ump makes a bad call, and the next thing you know, a bunch of loudmouth parents are at his and each other's throat, literally. It almost makes 50,000 fans chanting in unison that Boston sucks at Yankee Stadium seem as carefree as take me out to the ball game during the seventh inning stretch. Today, we live in an age of entitlement. Not all fans, of course, but way too many believe that if they feel like saying it, they should go right ahead. They're entitled. But until recently, sports was different. It was a refuge, the place where we got away from all the other crap polluting our culture. Now, it's become a great big arena where we can say anything we want, as loud and nasty and ugly as it may be, simply because we want to. Which brings us back to John Green, the Detroit fan who threw the beer that started the whole thing. When the Detroit Pistons management informed Green that his season tickets would be revoked, this is what he said. If they ban me, they should ban Artest and the other players involved in the fight. Otherwise, it's unequal. It's discrimination. Get it? John Green is the victim here. All he did was instigate a brawl that could have turned into a full-scale riot. After all, he did pay for his ticket. He is entitled to express himself. He is a fan, isn't he? 28. Julian Bond. I first met Julian Bond in the mid-70s when I was a young reporter with CBS News in Atlanta, and he was a young politician flirting with the idea of running for President of the United States. One day on the road, we were chatting about something or other, when he casually said, "When I was a kid, Albert Einstein came over to my house one day, and he told me," before he could go on, I jumped in with, "Who came over to your house one day?" He couldn't have said Einstein. No 10-year-old kid knows Albert Einstein. But after repeating that it was indeed Albert Einstein who came over to visit his friends Mr. and Mrs. Bond and young Julian too, he went on to make his point. Einstein told me, never memorize anything you can write down. I'm not sure, so many years later, why he told me that story, But what I'll never forget is the way Julian Bond so effortlessly dropped Albert Einstein's name into the conversation, with no more emphasis than if he were saying, "Billy Johnson, my friend from next door, came over to my house one day to watch TV." He wasn't bragging, just telling a story. Maybe because he was just a kid at the time. Maybe because his parents were well-educated and he was used to meeting important people, the visit apparently was no big deal to him. But it was a big deal to me, who came from a tenement in the Bronx. Growing up, I didn't know anybody famous. And I admit it, I was impressed with Julian Bond. He was smooth, he was cool, and he was very smart. Julian Bond, as they say, was a man of great promise. Today, he's the chairman of the NAACP, and I am truly sad to say, the individual more responsible than anyone else for undermining the civil rights organization's moral foundation. Once, the NAACP, which is the oldest and largest civil rights group in America, was also the most respected. Once great men ran the organization, and no matter how bad things were for black people, they took the high road. Today, the NAACP no longer has any special moral standing. Today, it's just one more highly politicized special interest group, like the abortion lobby or the teachers union. More than anyone else, Julian Bond hijacked the supposedly nonpartisan NAACP and set it down firmly inside the left wing of the Democratic Party. And like so many other supposed progressives, Julian Bond seems to be mired in the past. For Bond, when it comes to race, it's as if not much has changed in the past 40 years, except now the bigots wear suits and ties. But let Julian Bond speak for himself. In 2001, he had this to say about the president and his new administration. "They selected nominees from the Taliban wing of American politics, appeased the wretched appetites of the extreme right wing, and chose cabinet officials whose devotion to the Confederacy is nearly canine in its uncritical affection." And during the presidential campaign of 2004, Bond continued down the same old road, saying the Republican Party's idea of equal rights is the American flag and the Confederate swastika flying side by side. Republicans, he said, want to write bigotry back into the Constitution. Never mind that this overheated rhetoric can only breed ill will and suspicion between the races. For Julian Bond, it is always 1965, and America is Selma, Alabama. How ironic Rod Page, President Bush's then education secretary and lifelong member of the NAACP, wrote in the Wall Street Journal that Bond and then NAACP President Kwesi Anfume would direct his vitriol at a president who has appointed more African Americans to high-profile posts, has committed more funds to fight AIDS in Africa, has championed minority home ownership, and has supported more trade and aid for African and Caribbean nations than any other administration. When I contacted Julian Bond in the summer of 2004, he was gracious and gentlemanly. About that Confederate swastika quote, Bond had this to say: "I've read that I've accused Republicans of being Nazis because I've spoken of their fondness for the Confederate swastika. While you or others may find that rhetorically over the top, it seems a stretch from that to calling them Nazis." Really? Can such a smart man Nazi how a reasonable person would connect the dots between Confederate swastika and come up with Nazi, even though, as he says, he never actually used the word? Can such a smart man not understand how over-the-top rhetoric often produces over-the-top reactions? Sorry, but it doesn't take an Einstein or the old Julian Bond to figure that out. 27. Paul Begala. By now, it's old news that Paul Begala, the CNN commentator and a primary architect, along with business partner James Carville, of Bill Clinton's rise to the presidency in 1992, is a left-wing hate monger. So it could be that what he wrote back in November 2000, a column equating Bush voters with bigots and murderers, may also seem a bit old. Still, it's more than worth revisiting, not for the sake of nostalgia, but for some insight about a man so many liberals still hold in high regard, and mostly for some insight on today's liberal mind in general. The story begins in the days right after the chaotic election of 2000, when we still didn't know who the next president would be. On MSNBC, Mike Barnicle, the commentator, held up a map of the United States and, noting the red states for Bush in the middle of the country and the blue states for Gore on the coasts, said that this was evidence of a cultural divide in America. Walmart versus Martha Stewart, as Barnicle put it. Family values versus a sense of entitlement. The Walmart versus Martha Stewart thing wasn't such a big deal, but the crack about family values versus a sense of entitlement deeply offended Begala's liberal sensibilities, so he responded in a written column a week later. Yes, Barnicle is right when he notes that tens of millions of good people in middle America voted Republican, Begala wrote. But if you look closely at that map, he said, you see a more complex picture. You see the state where James Byrd was lynch-dragged behind a pickup truck until his body came apart. It's red. You see the state where Matthew Shepard was crucified on a split-rail fence for the crime of being gay. It's red. You see the state where right-wing extremists blew up a federal office building and murdered scores of federal employees. It's red. The state where an army private who was thought to be gay was bludgeoned to death with a baseball bat, and the state where neo-Nazi skinheads murdered two African Americans because of their skin color, and the state where Bob Jones University spews its anti-Catholic bigotry, they're all red too, Begala concluded. Linking Republicans who did absolutely nothing wrong, except, of course, vote for George W. Bush, with bombers and racists and homophobes was indeed a smear in a hate-filled column, as some writers had suggested. Except, as you might have guessed, Paul Begala didn't quite see it that way. "I'd like to report a mugging," he began a follow-up column. And guess who got mugged? Right, Paul Begala himself. What Mike Barnicle said about family values versus entitlement, Begala wrote, was both superficial and wrong. To show an equally superficial and equally wrong view of middle America, I listed a series of atrocities that occurred in states that voted Republican for president. A black man who was lynched, men who were murdered because others thought they were gay, right-wing terrorist bombings. Both before and after that parade of atrocities, I made it clear that I did not think those places could be judged solely by those monstrous crimes. What do you suppose Paul Begala would say if someone like Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity had written the following? New York, the state where a Jewish rabbinical student was stabbed to death by a black man who was part of a frenzied anti-Semitic black mob, was a blue state that voted for Al Gore. California, the state where rioters hauled an innocent, helpless man out of his truck and beat him senseless with a brick, was a blue state. The states with the most people on welfare, they're blue states too. And what would Paul Begala say if Rush or Sean tried to worm his way out of the firestorm that he alone created by saying, "I was mugged by those mean liberals who distorted what I said"? I'll tell you exactly what Paul Begala would say. Be a man. Admit what you did. Admit you intentionally tried to smear innocent people in the most shameful way for cheap political gain, is what he'd say. As one of the premier smear artists of our day, Paul Begala has been called the Joe McCarthy of the Democratic Party. While the comparison may be a tad unfair to the late senator, let me put a question to Begala that was once put to McCarthy, a question that very much applies today. Have you no sense of decency, sir? At long last, have you left no sense of decency? 26. Dr. Martin Haskell. Doctors have been some of humanity's most noble servants. Dr. Albert Schweitzer won a Nobel Prize for his work with the needy in French Equatorial Africa, then used his prize money to build a colony so lepers could live in peace. Dr. Jonas Salk freed humanity from the scourge of polio. Dr. Robert Gallo has been a tireless fighter in the long campaign against AIDS. Then there's Dr. Martin Haskell. Dr. Haskell's claim to fame is that in 1992, he pioneered the procedure known as partial birth abortion. He's also responsible for creating the technical term, dilation and extraction, DNE, that the defenders of this procedure use to obscure what it actually means, the killing of a fully formed preborn human being accomplished by the insertion of scissors into the base of the head, followed by the suction machine sucking out the brain. Frankly, I don't care how anyone feels about abortion. Reasonable people, as they say, may disagree. But this is something else entirely. This is something that is as barbaric as it seems. And unlike many of the procedure's defenders, like NARAL Pro-Choice America President Kate Mickelman, Dr. Haskell never has pretended the procedure is rare or that it is performed primarily to safeguard the health of the mother. Dr. Haskell has personally performed the procedure over 1,000 times, usually on healthy women. This is how Dr. Haskell explained in a 1993 interview with Cincinnati Medicine how he began using the procedure. I noticed that some of the latter DNEs were very, very easy, so I asked myself, why can't they all happen this way? You see, with the easy ones, you'd reach up and grab the foot of the fetus, pull the fetus down and the head would hang up, and then you would collapse the head and take it out. It was easy. At first, I would reach around trying to identify a lower extremity, a foot, blindly, with the tip of my instrument. I'd get it right about 30 to 50% of the time. Then I said, well, gee, if I just put the ultrasound up there, I could see it all, and I wouldn't have to feel around for it. I did that, and sure enough, I found it 99% of the time. Kind of serendipity. Well, Doc, if you could just wait a little while until the baby was born, then put a bullet in its head, that would be even easier. 10 years later, in 2003, at a national conference of abortion providers, Haskell narrated a video of the procedure, walking the audience through it step by grisly step. When he was done, the unborn child destroyed, his audience applauded enthusiastically. Every person in that crowd deserves to be on the list, but Dr. Haskell is an eminently worthy stand-in for the whole sorry bunch. 25. James Kopp. On October 23, 1998, anti-abortion extremist James Kopp murdered Dr. Bernard Slepian, a Buffalo-area gynecologist who performed abortions. Kopp was hiding in the woods near Dr. Slepian's house, armed with his Russian-made assault rifle, waiting for the doctor to come into view. Inside the kitchen, Slepian was microwaving a bowl of soup while talking to his wife and one of his four children. When he walked across the room and appeared in the crosshairs, Kopp fired a shot, hitting Dr. Slepian in the back and killing him. I consider this a crime of the worst magnitude, District Attorney Frank J. Clark told the Buffalo News. A man was gunned down in his own home while his family was there. It was an assassination. As for Kopp, he said it was his reverence for life that made him do what he did. He also said that he didn't really mean to kill the doctor. He wanted to wound him. The jury didn't buy it. Kopp was convicted of murder and sentenced to 25 years to life, a small price to pay as far as he was concerned. Why should the safety of Dr. Slepian be put over the safety of unborn children, he asked. I wish I could do 10 life sentences or 10 death penalties to save them. This made a lot of sense to Kopp's supporters, who affectionately referred to him as Atomic Dog. Words fail in the face of such chilling hypocrisy and self-delusion. Save us, please, from James Kopp and all the other murderous zealots out there who have convinced themselves that they have the right to play God. 24. Lee Bollinger. The best way to talk about Columbia University President Lee Bollinger, the most dogged defender of racial preferences on American campuses, is to start by talking about Jennifer Gratz. Unlike Bollinger, Jennifer Gratz isn't the sort of person the press usually pays attention to. She doesn't get referred to as a distinguished academic, and no one gives her awards and honorary degrees, nor has she ever been asked to serve on corporate boards or the board of Britain's Royal Shakespeare Company. In fact, when she was growing up in a working-class Detroit suburb, the daughter of a retired police sergeant and a secretary, Jennifer Gratz's dream was pretty basic. She was hoping to be the first member of her family to get a college degree. She knew her family couldn't afford a swank school like Harvard, where Lee Bollinger's daughter went, but Jennifer Gratz was still aiming high. A hard worker who played by the rules, she graduated in the top 4% of her high school class and served as vice president of her student council. "I wouldn't ask any more of my own daughter," her former assistant principal told the Washington Post. Why was Jennifer Gratz in the Washington Post? Because at 17, she applied to the school she'd always dreamed of attending, the prestigious Ann Arbor campus of her state's taxpayer-funded university, the University of Michigan. And like too many other kids, she was rejected for the worst of all possible reasons, because of the color of her skin. At first, she was hurt and disappointed when her application was rejected. But later, she became shocked and angry when she learned that other kids who were clearly less qualified had been admitted, and for the same reason, the color of their skin. At the time, 1997, the president of the University of Michigan was Lee Bollinger, a longtime proponent of racial preferences, a term the left routinely rejects, even though that's exactly what it is, in favor of either affirmative action or the more current, and in their view, less threatening, diversity. So when Jennifer Gratz filed suit against the school, Lee Bollinger became not simply just another backer of racial preferences. He became America's foremost and most tireless public defender of the practice. Over the 6 years that Gratz versus Bollinger made its way through the courts, Bollinger gave countless interviews passionately arguing for a system that rewards some students for an accident of birth and punishing others. By the time the case was decided, in June 2003, the university had spent more than $10 million of public funds on the case, five times more than their opponents. And while the Supreme Court ruled in a 6-3 decision that the specific bean-counting formula the university had used to reject Gratz and others was illegal, it said that schools could still consider race and/or ethnicity as one of the many factors in making admissions decisions through a properly devised admissions program. In other words, they could keep doing exactly what they had been doing, but they should find a less obvious way of doing it. As a consequence of Bollinger's firm decision to defend affirmative action, as the Michigan student paper says admiringly, universities around the country have been able to enact policies to ensure racial diversity within the student bodies. Though technically she won her case, the ruling came far too late for Jennifer Gratz. She had already graduated from a less prestigious school. Of course, you can make the case that since blacks have been historically discriminated against in our society, there should be some kind of remedy, like affirmative action. But what Lee Bollinger never seemed to understand, or certainly never seemed to care very much about, is that in the days when the Old Boys Network threw its weight around and helped kids get into college, it wasn't just black kids who got the short end of the stick. It was also white, blue-collar kids, just like Jennifer Gratz. The Old Boys Network never looked out for them. They got screwed under the old system.